Hello and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the nature of birthright citizenship. And Richard, President Trump last week started making noise on Twitter about how he wanted to get rid of birthright citizenship. This is the practice under which someone born on American soil gets citizenship, even if, and this is where it's controversial, they're born to immigrants who are in the country illegally. So we should probably just start with the constitutional question here. As a legal matter, birthright citizenship is usually defended as an application of the 14th Amendment, the first sentence of which reads, "All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside." And Richard, it seems that this debate always hinges on that clause in the middle, subject to the jurisdiction thereof. So there's widespread disagreement over whether that encompasses illegal immigrants or not. Give us a sense of the most common theories of this and where you come down on it.
Well, I think the clause is overrated, but it is typical American constitutional law. You put a clause in there which, if you just read it, doesn't give you the information one way or another as to what you're supposed to do about the illegality. So what you then have to do is to try and find out some background source of one kind or another which will tell you exactly what it means. So you treat it as code. And the two meanings that have been given of it are diametrically opposite. Both of them have ancient pedigrees, and I think both of them are to some extent inadequate. And the first of those says, subject to the jurisdiction thereof, only refers to those people who are only excludes those people who are, diplomats and their families, because they have allegiance to somewhere else and they're given diplomatic immunity. There's also, I think, a widespread agreement, at least in the original understanding of all of this, that members of the various Indian tribes, as they were then known, Native Americans today, were also out from underneath that. That was changed by statute in 1924, where they were then included. The point is actually important, because what it means in effect is that this is not a definition of all the people who are citizens. And indeed, if it were, it would be a genuine revolution the other way, because it's widely understood that people born of American parents, indeed, even one American parents outside the continental of the United States, are citizens. They don't have to be naturalized, but there are a series of statutory hoops which they have to go, spending some time as of in the United States in order to claim their citizenship as of age 21 as of right. The other school, which is exemplified by a remark made but not fully defended in the Slaughterhouse cases, perhaps the most important case construing the 14th Amendment early on, says that essentially subject to the jurisdiction thereof excludes all people of foreign birth, unless to some extent they are going to be admitted into the United States, and would therefore exclude all illegal aliens, and arguably might even exclude all children born of aliens legal inside the United States. So they're very broad differences. And just to make the thing a little bit more complicated, in 1898, there was another set of decisions in a case called Wum Kim Ark, which made it very clear that if you were born of an alien who was a legal resident of the United States, left the country and sought to come back in, you were a citizen of the United States by virtue of the fact that you were born here. That was a decision which only applied to legal aliens. The question of illegality was never discussed one way or the other. And so, at least as a textual matter, you have these two diametrically opposed camps, and I'm basically not particularly happy with either of the arguments.
If we're trying to understand this clause, are there other explanatory tools that we can look to beyond just the text of the 14th Amendment?
Well, that's a leading question. Yeah, I think what one has to do is to understand that virtually every single provision that's written in the United States Constitution is always set up against various kinds of background understandings, and you have to be able to tease those out. So I've already mentioned one of them, which is that this clause was certainly not meant to upset the tradition in which American citizens overseas giving birth to children were in fact giving birth to children who were citizens of the United States. They would not fall within this general provision. The other thing that I think one has to do is to say that there is a kind of a background proposition which applies to virtually every portion of every doctrine that you care to mention, which is to say that nobody can profit from his or her own wrong. And this is a sort of general principle of illegality. And what happens is it's typically not addressed in the documents that you're talking about or in the arguments that you're talking about, but when raised, it tends to turn everything upside down. So, for example, if you wanted to figure out what does it mean when we start to say that you have to make a contract, what you say is, well, I make an offer, you make an acceptance, there's a bargain on both sides, we agree as to terms, and so therefore this thing is prima facie enforceable. And then somebody says, suppose it's a contract to kill a third person, and everybody says, whoops, it may be a contract in some form or another, but it's certainly not going to be unenforceable, because what happens is to enforce that is essentially to encourage mayhem. So there is an implied provision in virtually every area of the law having to do with contractual organizations that illegal actions do not receive any kind of protection. And that argument can carry over to this particular case. If you look at the situation in Wong Kim Ark, one of the things that you can say is we really do want to encourage various aliens to settle in the United States. And one of the strongest inducements that you could possibly give to those individuals is to make it clear to them that their children born inside the United States are full participant members of the overall system. And so you treat this as a bonus for essentially bringing people into the country at a time when immigration was certainly regarded as a strength of the country rather than a weakness. But that argument works exactly in the opposite way. If people are here illegally in the country or get here legally and then overstay their welcome in one form or another, we don't want to encourage that kind of behavior. And the worst thing you can do, therefore, under this model is to give them the added bonus of having children whose citizenship is indistinguishable from that of the children of legal aliens or from any other American citizen. If you're trying to discourage the basic behavior, you have to do this collaterally. And this works two ways. Way number one is it turns out that people just sneak into the United States and give birth to children and or bring their children in one way or another. And what you want to say is, no, you can't do that particular thing because we want to discourage people from coming in. The other situation is what do you do with the so-called sojourner? People come in under a visa. The visa is a tourist visa that lasts for several months. If you give birth to a child, does that child get to stay longer than the original visa? The parents can stay. And the traditional rule is that if you are given a visa or permission to enter property for a limited period of time, it doesn't allow you to stay there in perpetuity. And when the limited period of time is over, then the host of the property can ask you to leave and, if necessary, call the police or use force in order to get you to remove. And it would be very odd to say that if you have a sojourner who is a resident in their home country and they give birth in the United States, that child is a resident in the state in which they reside because, in fact, they're a resident of their homeland. And if you're not going to say that they're residents of their own state, it seems very odd to say that they are then citizens of the United States. So looking at this whole thing together, it seems to me that the stronger argument is, both as a matter of incentive and as a matter of general statutory construction, that the children of illegal aliens or people here under limited visas share the status of their parents and cannot rise above what that particular status is. This has nothing to do with any of the political struggles that we have one way or another. It just seems to me to be a more accurate construction of a document which is filled with all sorts of implications. So put it in another way, if one looked at the 14th Amendment and asked the following geopolitical question: did you mean to change the basic way in which citizenship works with respect to the rest of the world? I think the answer to that question would have been no. And so allowing not only people of African descent to become citizens if born in this country and there legally, but anybody else who's here legally is consistent with that view. Illegal aliens is not.
So if that's the case, Richard, the president has talked about getting rid of birthright citizenship via executive order. Is there a plausible argument that he can do that?
Oh, that is so terribly complicated. The answer, in short, is probably no, but let's start to see what happens if he tries to do it. President Barack Obama tried to do that with the Iraq Treaty. And the basic conceit was if you do it by way of executive order, what is going to happen is so long as the executive order is in effect, you can keep the policy. Another president comes in and removes the executive order, and everything else immediately changes. So there is a sense in which the highly contingent and haphazard nature of this situation makes it a peculiarly inept way to do this. The second problem is, do you want to distinguish between people who are already declared citizens, though born illegally in the United States, because of prior practice, which is pretty consistent in this particular fashion? I do not believe that the president, by executive order, can unravel the status of people who have already been regarded as citizens by all sorts of other things. There is, however, no reliance interest going forward with respect to people who have not been in the country and who may at some future time arrive illegally. But again, I would think it would be extremely difficult for him to do it by executive order, because if it turns out that the traditional view is correct, somebody who is denied entry under this situation, that or his children are ordered to leave, will certainly have standing to protest the executive order. And if the Constitution requires otherwise, then what the president said will surely have to go by the wayside. So I think the sensible thing to recognize is that this question is surely ultimately going to end up in the lap of the United States Supreme Court, should there be any effort by either the president or the Congress to do it. What I think that Donald Trump can do is could tee up the issue if he wants to do so. And if he did, Lord knows which way this particular case would come out. My own view about this is that there will be many people who will say, look, the established practice really ought to govern this case. We don't care what the original intention was, and that would certainly favor the retention of the current rule. I tend to split the difference in saying those people who have relied on the incorrect interpretation should be protected, but those people who have yet to come here and have not relied should not be protected. It's anybody's guess as to the way this thing would start to come out, because the last relevant precedents that we have are, you know, over 100 years old, and nobody quite knows what the tenor of the Supreme Court is going to be in dealing with this set of issues.
You said the president wouldn't have the power to unilaterally revoke the citizenship of people who had been given their citizenship under the existing birthright policy. Would Congress have the ability? Would they be on stronger footing?
They would certainly have the advantage that their decision, if it were valid, would not be able to be upended except by legislation, so it would be more entrenched. But again, if the Constitution requires otherwise, then passing a statute which turns out to be unconstitutional is not going to change the situation. What it would do is it would provoke perhaps even more fierce battle on this thing, because the legislation is generally of greater durability than an executive order. But I think ultimately the president is not a great constitutional lawyer, and one way or another this thing will end up in the lap of the Supreme Court. As we say in the jargon, if there's any case which is cert-worthy, that is, worthy of the Supreme Court hearing it, this one certainly has to be that particular decision, and that's what I think will happen. If I had to make a prediction, I make the prediction that I often make, which is my arguments, which I find quite persuasive, will generally not carry the sentiments of the public at large. If you look amongst conservative writers, you will see that there's a very deep disagreement amongst them. I quote some of them in there. Everybody on the left is uniform on the other side. There are many people who say there's a deep contradiction here because all of these so-called originalists are now not doing originalist work. My own view about that is it's incorrect. Originalism, whatever it means, is much more than textualism. It requires that you understand all the background assumptions that surround various constitutional provisions. And once you understand that, it turns out things are more complicated. Let me give you another example, which I didn't talk about in my column, but which I think actually shows you how it is when you change arrangements by indirection, there's going to be a fierce reaction. There is a provision in the Constitution as of 1787 which says that the federal courts have jurisdiction over cases brought against the state by citizens of another state. And in the case of Chisholm against Georgia, somebody from South Carolina, I believe, but it doesn't matter, sues the state of Georgia in federal court. Georgia says, you know what, we are entitled to sovereign immunity. And since we're entitled to sovereign immunity, you throw this thing out. Because after all, if they sued us in our own state court, they would not be able to get a dime. And the Supreme Court went the other way. And so the question you have to ask is, when they gave federal jurisdiction over these disputes, did they really mean to upend without so much a word of comment the doctrine of sovereign immunity, which has been a central piece of American constitutional law, even as of that early date, because it was a central piece of all the common law that we got and the constitutional law we got from England. And there was a fierce reaction. It said, we didn't agree to this. We agreed to allow you to sue in federal court, but we should be able to raise a sovereign immunity defense there just as we could in state court. And there was an amendment passed, the 11th Amendment, not quite right in terms of its drafting, which undid the decision. And my attitude is generally that the principles of illegality, like the principles of sovereign immunity, are very much entrenched into the system. And so I think it's a very dangerous thing to say that when a text is silent about the question of illegality, the implication should be it's irrelevant to the situation. I think rather the background assumptions about illegality, which is you can't profit from your own wrong, which apply to private law, also carry over to constitutional law. So the more accurate interpretation would in fact be the other way. I would be quite confident about this if the year were 1869 and the 14th Amendment were just put on the books, if somebody had raised the question how it would turn out. But as you know, the question of immigration has become perhaps one of the two or three hottest issues in American public life today. So nobody's going to have an attitude towards that similar to that which they had back in 1868 when the 14th Amendment was adopted.
Well, to that point, the last question that I'll put to you, even among some people who agree with the president on this principle, you will hear the refrain that, you know what, in the hierarchy of issues around immigration, this one is pretty low. You occupy an interesting place in this debate. You're generally pretty pro-immigration, but you don't share the, I guess we'd call them open borders convictions. I don't mean that as an epithet, but some of your fellow libertarians who will describe themselves that way. But yes. How do you think about that hierarchy when it comes to immigration? What are the most important issues that the federal government should be focusing on when it comes to this?
I think this is a very important issue. I mean, as generally speaking, I'm in favor of trying to lower the barriers to immigration from people throughout the world. I think there's a very reputable debate going on as to whether or not this should be for people with family connections, whether it should be for refugees, for people who bring business skills, graduate students, and so forth to the United States. But the reason why I think the citizenship debate is there is that I think when the United States decides it wants to admit more or fewer people as a collective decision, it should have the say as to which of these people are going to stay. And that is not going to be the case if illegality of the parental arrival essentially protects the birthright citizenship in the United States. So I regard this as a kind of an uneasy challenge to the sanctity of the borders. I don't think it's a very wise policy to say that if we manage to keep you out, your children remain aliens, but if you manage to sneak in, not. I think essentially the situation should be the same in both cases. I think Congress is certainly entitled to say with respect to birthright citizen situations that they can remedy the defect in any way they see fit so that it's a political debate. But I don't think that that should be foreclosed by the constitutional interpretation of what the 14th Amendment says. And exactly who gets in under this, I think I can say there are many problems about which I'm very confident of what the right answer is. Ask me about the minimum wage, I will get on my soapbox. But this is one which I think bedevils just about everybody. I will mention that most nations over the globe essentially take the same attitude that we do or that I do with respect to birthright citizenship. It's not widely granted. I think it is in Canada, but very few other places are doing that. And in fact, in many places, the controls are even tighter in terms of who gets to stay and how long they get to stay and what happens to children. I think every nation has the right to defend its own borders. Open immigration simply will not work. If it turns out you could get 5 million people coming in every week from overseas, landing in San Francisco and saying, here I am, find a place for me, The dislocations will be too large. There was a very powerful piece this morning by Jill Melchior in the Wall Street Journal explaining just how difficult it is when you go to the Mexican border to figure out how you process all the people coming across into the United States. There are refugee claims. There are illness issues. There are legal issues. There are return issues. There are documentation issues and so forth. And what she does is she describes the situation as one in which we are essentially swamped. And I think that that's probably a very accurate description. And what was so powerful about her article is the nature of the difficulty was not tied to the caravan. That's a relatively small number of people. It was tied to the way in which these businesses operate today. United States is a huge attraction to people whose lives overseas are really very, very miserable. I understand why they want to come here. But if you were to open up the floodgates, to use the term quite accurately, on the southern border of Mexico, this country would be violently transformed in a way that many, many people would find difficult. So I'm in this strange position. In the immigration debate, I would put myself is kind of a centrist, slightly more sympathetic to immigration than many other people. But on the constitutional issue, I think that you have to be able to control the borders. And I don't think it's the caravan which is the problem. I think it is, in fact, the general situation that one sees, particularly on the Mexican border. You don't see it on the Canadian border because that country is more stable, more prosperous than our own. And so what happens is we really have to figure out how it is that we can maintain our so-called island of prosperity in a sea of despair. That's an extremely difficult thing to do. One of the things I wish Donald Trump would do is to encourage free trade agreements with Mexico and everybody else, because the best way that I know to reduce the immigration crisis is to make things more attractive for people back in their home countries. And the only way in which you could do that is to buy their goods. And you won't do that if you start shutting down various kinds of contractual arrangements. And so I think the case for free trade is enormously powerful. The case for free immigration is much more difficult because people who are immigrants, they have children, they vote, they influence political communities, they put demands on the way things go, and they present in some cases health issues. It's just a very, very difficult kind of problem to deal with. I think in many cases, what she said is we spend an enormous amount of resources trying to make the lives of people who are in these desperate situations more bearable than otherwise be the case. And I'm certainly in favor of doing that and expanding the service if you need to. But I think it's fair to say that no matter which way you come out on birthright citizenship, it's going to be a billion-dollar problem, a multi-billion-dollar problem. And ironically, if in fact you have a world in which there is birthright citizenship, there will be even more strenuous efforts to keep out illegal aliens.
You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at hoover.org, and you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.